On November 16th, in the predominantly Palestinian city of Hebron, a gun battle erupted between Palestinian militants and armed paramilitary Jewish settlers. There were 12 Israeli soldiers and settlers killed in the attack. The armed settlers and soldiers serving the role of the occupying force, defending illegal Israeli settlements in Hebron. Despite the fact that those killed were soldiers and armed settlers, the Israeli government, under pressure from Foreign Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, issued a statement which lied in stating that those killed in the attack were, quote, Jewish worshippers and their guards as they were walking home from Sabbath prayers. The dead included civilian worshippers and soldiers, some of whom were caught in an ambush as they pursued the attackers, end quote. Despite the untruthfulness of the Israeli government's statement of the events of November 16th, international corporate media networks picked up the story and took it at face value, justifying a crushing Israeli response to the events. Haaretz, an Israeli daily, has corrected the facts of the incident and printed an article which read, quote, according to an initial investigation by the army, in contrast to the version of the events given by the foreign ministry, the Islamic Jihad fire was not directed at worshippers, but at the security forces escorting them, end quote. This distortion of the facts represents a continuing effort of the Israeli state to misrepresent the realities of the occupation. This deadly misrepresentation being taken at face value throughout the world, justifying deadly Israeli responses. Prime Minister Sharon is proposing that Israel, quote, quickly expand the Hebron settlements. We talked with Nigel Perry and Aliyu Benima of electronicintifada.net, who published an article about the events of November 16th, called Israeli falsely claims, quote, massacre of, quote, worshippers in Hebron. First off, we've heard about the 12 people being killed in Hebron, but could you break it down and explain who was killed, why, and what was the context? Ali, maybe you could start.
Yes, well, on Friday night, Friday afternoon, actually all day, all of the world media, CBC, CNN, everyone, reported that there had been an appalling massacre of Jewish worshippers in the occupied West Bank city of Hebron, and that Palestinian gunmen had opened fire on these worshippers while they were walking home from the Tomb of the Patriarchs to the settlement of Kiryat Arba, and that a number of people had been killed. Some reports said that they were all settlers, all worshippers. Others said it was a mixture of civilian worshippers and soldiers who'd rushed to the scene to protect them. Now, it eventually emerged that, in fact, the attackers had waited until all of the settlers had returned safely to the settlement. And it was a carefully staged ambush directed solely at Israeli occupation forces. And all of the 12 people who died were armed combatants. 9 of them were Israeli occupation soldiers, and 3 of them were armed settler paramilitaries. And all of the wounded, similarly, were armed combatants. This is now incontrovertible. Nobody denies it. But the question which we sought to answer is, how is it that the media got the story so wrong, and that these false reports, utterly false, fabricated reports, persisted for several days? And in fact, you might still find at some websites and news organizations reports of an attack on Jewish worshippers that never happened. What happened is a combination of things, but the main feature is that the new Israeli foreign minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, made a decision at the very highest political level to spin the story, to tell outright lies to the media, and to get their story in print on everyone's breakfast table the following morning. And in fact, they succeeded. We know that Netanyahu stated as soon as there was news of an incident that this was, they called it the Shabbat evening massacre. The foreign ministry spokesman of Israel said, quote, this Sabbath massacre is the second time in a week that innocent civilians have been senselessly murdered either in their beds or on their way to prayers. and Netanyahu condemned killings of innocents, of worshippers. They knew that was false at the time, but they decided to put that story out anyway. I'll let Nigel talk perhaps about what happened next.
Go ahead, Nigel.
Well, one of the main... It took literally 2 days after the incident for news organizations to begin reporting what the Israeli army itself announced the following day, which was that none of the... According to initial investigation, I'm quoting from Haaretz, which is an Israeli daily newspaper, in contrast to a version of events given by the foreign ministry, the Islamic Jihad fire was not directed at worshippers, but at the security forces escorting them. All of the dead were from the IDF, water police, or emergency security team of the settlers of Kiryat Arba and Hebron. And what was interesting about this was just how slow the corrections have been in coming in. I mean, all yesterday, Ali was monitoring NPR and just the process of... How they were reporting the news. And yesterday I was having a look at how CNN was doing it, as they were two kind of interesting and representative networks. And pretty much everyone had, I guess because the initial wire service reports were erroneous and suggested this was attack on a sort of procession of the pious, that, you know, this fact, this is the accepted fact, then became part of the narrative of how this had happened, and without anyone questioning it. And even though now there's been several articles in Haaretz, in the Jerusalem Post, which opened up by noting that the all clear had sounded on the soldiers' radios, meaning that the worshippers had been safely escorted to their homes, and it is an incontrovertible fact. You still can't find on many media organizations any sense that this wasn't an attack on worshippers, which is quite disturbing in this day and age, because, of course, these days we can expect live images from the scene of an event, a news event, within minutes, thanks to the technology available. But it just still seems that ensuring accuracy is a major problem for many, even well-funded international media networks.
Yasser Arafat stated that this was a justified attack on an occupying force. Can you speak about the events that ensued after this event happened? What events were somehow, quote-unquote, justified by the Israeli Defense Forces after the attack happened?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the clear patterns during the Intifada is that Palestinian land, in the wake of these events, has typically been confiscated for security reasons. The way this seems to happen without international opprobrium is an attack will take place in the vicinity or around a settlement. I mean, and when I say attack here, I don't necessarily mean a bomb attack or someone shooting at a settlement, but even sustained stone throwing at a certain area around it. And the Israeli army will come in, take control of that area, maybe bulldoze Palestinian homes and olive groves and other agricultural areas, and then, you know, present this as part of the security needs in this instance, and basically cast it as self-defense. And in the first year alone of the Intifada, one-fifth of Gaza's agricultural land was dispensed with in such a way, which obviously has a massive impact on the Palestinian economy. Gaza's economy is 80% of it's dependent on agriculture, and unemployment now is ranging well over 65%. So, I mean, these things do have a very measurable in square feet, you know, cost on the ground, which is very apparent to Palestinians, but doesn't seem to somehow be reflected on the international media quite as loudly as we think it should. I mean, this is essentially a conflict over land, and every day, somewhere, a bulldozer is moving in one direction from the Israeli side into the Palestinian side. The land is being lost progressively on a daily basis by one side. And there's just, in a day, I mean, the problem with the international media is that yesterday's news isn't that interesting anymore. So we're left in a situation where, well, that parcel of land, those few acres over there that was bulldozed or confiscated yesterday isn't really the focus anymore. So there's just this ongoing and steady swallowing up of land that's going on that's perhaps not as interesting in coverage terms, not very visual, sometimes hard to represent visually because essentially the land may look the same. It just, the borders have moved of where people feel they can go safely into their fields and collect their olive groves, as we saw in the last month.
Yeah. On the topic of olive groves, people here in Montreal recently had the chance to listen to the speeches of two different people who traveled to Palestine with the International Solidarity Movement. And as they described the continued demolition of Palestinian olive groves and in the attempts to build the security wall are ongoing on a daily basis. In the article, you quoted CNN as saying, we told you at the top of the hour, a Jewish Sabbath celebration turned deadly in the West Bank today. Israeli authorities say at least 12 people were killed in Hebron when Palestinian militants opened fire on a group of Jews on their way to prayer services. Now, Ali, could you speak about that relationship between the corporate media and their complicity in these kind of acts that are happening on a daily basis, for instance, the uprooting of olive groves?
Well, that's a complicated question. I think that you can understand the role of the media at a very micro level and at a very macro level, and sometimes it's useful to look at one and sometimes at the other. But I think that Nigel hit some of the key points. The large networks and news organizations and wire services are like machines that turn out hundreds of thousands of words and images a day, and their main purpose is to make money. And for that reason, we've seen a lot of consolidation in recent years, which leads to a cutting of expertise, a cutting of staff. So the people who are approaching stories are often not terribly experienced, don't have a lot of background, and look for the story that's easy to package and digest and is not too politically offensive. I mean, we see a great deal of fear, I think, in the media when you talk to journalists off the record. They're very wary about what they report about this particular story because the pressure, political and financial pressure brought to bear against organizations that are accused of being anti-Israeli is immense, and there aren't that many people who think they should put themselves on the line for that. Having said that, there are some very good reporters and some journalists who do put themselves on the line and who do brave the slander and the defamation that is part and parcel of the job of trying to report accurately on what Israel is doing to the Palestinians.
Now, have you seen much accurate coverage of these recent events? You said there were some corrections. For instance, Haaretz did run an article which corrected the details of the event. What about other news networks like CNN?
Well, Haaretz, I mean, did do that in a way that's admirable, and it's particularly credible when it comes from an Israeli source. But on the other hand, Haaretz has an interest in it because they're there every day, and for them, it's a story every day. But as Nigel pointed out, if you're CNN or CBC or any of these other newspapers, you've moved on to the next story. And, you know, yesterday's, as they say, you know, yesterday's newspaper is, or today's newspaper is tomorrow's birdcage liner. So they don't have much of an interest in going back to look at the situation. But on the other hand, there is a double standard here. I mean, a major double standard. If you cast your mind back to earlier this year when it was alleged that senior Palestinian officials had accused Israel of killing 500 people in Jenin. In fact, no Palestinian official ever made that charge. But the media accepted the Israeli claim that Palestinian officials had said this, and they went on to castigate Palestinian officials for making false claims. Well, here we have a deliberate deception by the Israeli Foreign Ministry, a conscious decision, a political decision at the highest level to mislead the media. And nobody dares to comment on it. And I think that that really should worry us, since we all rely on our morning radio or newspaper or television to tell us what's going on in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Stefan, some of the... it was in the old days of the government press office in Israel. The journalists would, of course, use this as a base. This was the main place they'd pick up the daily press statements from the Israeli government. And the government press office was in the same office as the Israeli government spokesperson. And, of course, I'm not using hyperbole when I say that no foreign journalists live in Palestinian-controlled areas. I mean, that's just not the case. There's at any one time several hundred foreign correspondents registered in Israel, and none of them live in Palestinian-controlled areas. All of them live in Israeli-controlled areas. And this just works, I think, to give us a subtle sense of the Palestinians are the outsiders. And I myself lived in Ramallah for 4 years during the implementation of Oslo. And one of the things you'd notice is that journalists essentially came in as tourists for day trips. And it was just amazing just seeing them interact with Palestinians. They'd come in, they'd try and get a soundbite or two and pretty much leave. And there was no real dedication to uncovering the background. And essentially what's the biggest story of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is never untold. One journalist once said to, I used to work at Birzeit University, and they came into the human rights office and said to one of the people working there, there's just nothing to report these days, you know. And what they meant by that was there was no clashes between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian youth, and there was no major meetings between Arafat and, well, at that time it would have been Rabin and Peres. So, I mean, there's just a sense of that what's news has got to be some sort of handshaking between leaders or violence, essentially. And the untold story, which is that every Palestinian who's under 36 years of age has only ever known military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza. And daily life for the 3 million Palestinians that live there is miserable. I mean, you can't travel more than a few miles in one direction without encountering a checkpoint, which, of course, makes normal life, study, work, hospital visits, anything that requires movement, very difficult. And this has an incredible effect of ramping up the tension, and it's been pretty much daily life since the beginning of the Oslo process. And that's not something that's very visual or easy to cover, but is utterly profound and probably guides the conflict more than any other single factor, this sense of caging and containing Palestinians within small geographical areas.
Ali, do you have any comments on the realities facing Palestinians under occupation, the media's coverage of those realities?
Well, how many people know or really can grasp the reality that's reported today? Again, the United Nations has stated, and this is the second time in a few months, that the situation of malnutrition in the occupied territories is now as severe as that in Zimbabwe and the Congo. Who can imagine that? I mean, Israel is richer than many members of the European Union, and they rule over 3+ million people who have a rate of malnutrition the same as or worse than sub-Saharan Africa. Who really can grasp what that means? And the UN points out in its various in its report today that this is entirely man-made. There's been no natural disaster. There's been no crop failure. There's been no drought. This is an entirely result of the fact that the Palestinian people are caged in like animals. They can't go to work. They can't sow their fields. They can't harvest their crops. They can't pick their olives. They can't go out and do all the things that if you look out of the window now in Montreal, you'll see people doing on their way to work, on their way to school, on their way to university, on their way delivering the food that we buy in the supermarkets and so on. None of that goes on in Palestine. You have an entire country shut down by a military dictatorship. I mean, let's be frank. Israel rules the Palestinians through a military dictatorship, the very worst form of tyranny. And Israel feels this is normal and natural, and its spokesmen come on TV every day to defend it and to blame the Palestinians, to say that the Palestinians have only themselves to blame for the fact that they live as subjects of a military dictatorship of which they're not even citizens. This is such an abnormal situation. And I think the media have managed to normalize it, to make it seem that you have two sides that are somehow equal and they just can't get along, and to completely delete from our consciousness the reality, the radical imbalance of power here, the fact that you have a country that is more powerful than any member of NATO except the United States, that is richer than Spain and Portugal and Greece and other European countries, that has every advantage of technology and is ruling over people who are now as poor, as hungry as the people of Congo. And this is somehow a dispute among two people who can't just get along. The radical theft of land, the fact that Israel, despite the far-reaching offers, the far-reaching compromises offered by the Palestinians, by the entire Arab League extending an offer to Israel for normal relations and peace within secure recognized borders, that Israel has utterly rejected this and continues to manifest its rejection by continuing every day to seize and colonize more and more Palestinian land. This is a reality. It's indisputable. No matter what spin you put on it, no matter how many times you say that shooting children dead with tanks and with assault rifles and firing rockets at civilian cars and houses, that that's just self-defense, even though you're actually occupying someone else's country. No matter how many times you say that, it doesn't take away this reality. What we need is the media to uncover this reality, to brave the attacks and the storms and the slander and the defamation, the charges of anti-Semitism, the charges of bias that come against anyone who dares to speak the truth. To the point, I mean, I have to say that although in the United States we are very critical of what our government is doing here on many levels, particularly with civil rights now, it still manages to shock us that in a university, courts can issue, in Canada, courts can issue injunctions to shut down discussions in a university. And I think this is part of an effort to shut down any debate. As soon as it became apparent that the Palestinian issue was alive on campuses in North America, that students were organizing themselves, that they were articulate, that they knew what they wanted, well, you know, there are different approaches. Here in the United States, pro-Israeli groups have gone to court and tried to get injunctions to stop conferences like the one that happened in Michigan a month or two ago about divestment from Israel. They haven't succeeded in doing that here, but it's shocking that they've made more progress doing that in Canada.
You've been listening to an interview with Nigel Perry and Ali Ibn-Nima of electronicantifada.net, speaking about the recent shootings in Hebron on November 16th and the Israeli government's distortion of the facts. Israeli authorities claiming that those killed by Palestinian gunfire were Jewish worshippers, while those killed on the 16th were Israeli army officials and armed settlers. If you'd like to read up-to-date analysis on the occupation of Palestine and the Intifada against it, visit www.electronicantifada.net. This piece was produced for CKUT Radio in Montreal by Stefan Christoph. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.